The court calls United States versus Altier. Counsel for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant David Jangowski, and I represent the appellant in this case, Petty Officer Altier, United States Navy. Chief Judge Baker, with your permission, I request 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Grant.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court should reverse the lower court for two reasons. First, the lower court misinterpreted Article 63. Under the lower court's approach, meaningful comparison between qualitatively different forms of punishment is now possible. But this approach is contrary to the language of Article 63, precedent, and sound public policy. This court should adopt a type-for-type or lineal approach to sentence comparison upon rehearing that is consistent with Article 63. Secondly, and alternatively, if this court agrees with the approach taken by the lower court, it should nevertheless reverse. A sentence of confinement for 30 days, restriction at hard labor for 45 days, forfeitures of $1,500 per month for 3 months, and reduction in pay grade to pay grade E5 is still more severe than a bad conduct discharge awarded at a special court-martial.
Counsel, before you get into the substance of your argument, could you take a look at Article 63 and give us your definition of the two phrases in excess of and more severe than, and explain whether they're the same, whether they're different, and how that difference might apply to this case?
Certainly, Your Honor. That clause is the operative clause at issue here, the in excess of and more severe clause. And certainly when Congress uses language, it tends to mean something. And unless that in excess of language is mere surplusage, then it should relate to those forms of punishment in our military justice system which are quantifiable. So if we look at the New Oxford American Dictionary, the term excess refers to some amount that is more than desirable. Amount, of course, is something that's quantifiable. And we do have punishments that are quantifiable in our system. We have fines, we have forfeitures, and we have reductions in rank, for example, although that might be a type of punishment unto its own. And by contrast, we have this more severe language. Now, the more severe language does not lend itself to punishments that are quantifiable. Instead, it would seem to lend itself to punishments that are qualitative in nature. And we know this, for example, because in United States v. Mitchell, this court noted that the manual for courts martial specifically describes a dishonorable discharge as being more severe than a bad conduct discharge. And similarly, in the discussion section under RCM 304, the manual speaks of restriction in lieu of arrest being a less severe restraint on liberty than outright arrest. So we have the severe language, Your Honors, which we believe appeals to a qualitative paradigm under the punishments available at courts martial. And then we have the in excess of language, which applies to those punishments that are qualitative. So in this case, Your Honor, the language of the in excess clause would bar the sentence upon rehearing, because initially Petty Officer Altier was awarded no term of confinement.
Just to run that out then, if he received 1 day's confinement on the rehearing, you would say that's in excess.
Yes, sir. By definition, that would be in excess of the original sentence awarded at the court martial.
Is confinement per se always more severe than a punitive discharge?
Well, Your Honor, we wouldn't look at comparing confinement to a punitive discharge. As Chief Judge Perlack noted in his dissent, that necessarily compares the apple to the orange. And as this court stated in United States v. Rosendahl, and then 3 years later in United States v. Josie, confinement and punitive discharges carry with it their own ramifications. And it's so difficult to convert confinement credit, for example, to a punitive discharge that the court was not even willing to do so in those cases. So we wouldn't say that confinement would be more severe. Confinement would be under the in excess of rubric of the in excess of or more severe clause. And we would compare head to head whether or not there was any confinement initially. Now, if this court did want to look at a less severe restraint on liberty than confinement, certainly it could look at it in a future case whether or not restriction was authorized. Here there was restriction authorized, but there also wasn't any restriction initially awarded. So restraint would tend to be a less severe.
So what you're saying is you just line them up. It's like the elements test. You just line them up. Confinement. Hard labor without. I know that's antique language.
Yes.
Forfeitures. Fine. Punitive.
Well, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
This court certainly.
I'm just trying to get what you're saying.
Yes, Your Honor. And this court certainly could take that approach. An alternative approach would be the one endorsed by Judge Brosman in his concurring opinion in United States v. Keller. There, he didn't go strictly with actual types of punishment for actual types of punishment. In other words, whether or not a reprimand was awarded at court-martial versus whether a reprimand was awarded at rehearing. Instead, he looked at five different categories of punishment, referring to life, the loss of life with the death penalty, loss of liberty with respect to restriction or confinement, loss of reputation, which a punitive discharge would certainly impact a service member's reputation, defining his characterization of service or her characterization of service. And similarly, a reprimand would sound in reputation as well. Someone who's reprimanded or admonished at a court-martial has a stain or a pockmark on their record. So the court need not approach this case with a strict test that looks at precisely apples to apples when it gets to...
Okay, because here we have no apples. We have only oranges, you know.
We have
a BCD that went away.
Yes.
Now we have a stack of non-punitive discharge punishments.
You happen to have cited to two dissents for your model. So that suggests there's at least a third alternative. What is that third alternative, and how under that alternative do you or should you prevail?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, this appellant can also cite, and we do cite in our brief, to United States v. Mitchell. And there, this court tacitly endorsed, we believe, the approach that we advance today. And in United States v. Mitchell, a bad conduct discharge was awarded, along with 10 years confinement. And upon rehearing, this court analyzed the resentence, which was a dishonorable discharge, but 6 years confinement. So the punitive discharge went up, and the term of confinement went down. And this court stated in that case, Your Honor, that a dishonorable discharge is more severe than a bad conduct discharge. But, of course, 6 months confinement is not in excess of 10 years confinement. So we also rest on that case, Your Honor, in addition to the two the concurrence.
All right, let me try a different way. The CC majority, what analysis did they apply?
Well, we believe they conflated the terms in excess of with more severe to essentially mean what's worse, objectively what's worse.
And so they looked at the totality of the circumstances. Is that fair to say?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
And in doing that, if one chooses that third alternative, which at least the CCA chose to do, does one apply an objective or subjective test?
Well, Your Honor,
and I understand in your view you do neither because you go to your...
Sure. Yes, Your Honor. Well, one under that view would apply an objective test. But some of the case law that this court and this court's predecessor has observed also has some sort of subjective component. In certain cases, an appellant has asked or has proffered to the court that in the client's view, one sentence is more severe than another sentence. So there might be components of both under that test, Your Honor. But that test gets it wrong, because what it does is it also imports the language from Article 60, subsection C, which deals with the commutation power, to Article 63. And there's two key differences that this court should take note of when comparing those articles. First, under Article 60, subsection C, the convening authority is expressly authorized to change one nature of punishment into another nature. He can do that, and in United States v. Josie, this court noted that the convening authority is authorized to change a form of punishment into another. And two, the convening authority is only capped by language that states, so long as it's not more severe. So the in excess of clause is not present under Article 60. So there's an entirely different rubric because, one, that constraint is not present, the in excess of clause, and two, he's expressly authorized to change the nature of a punishment. So to the extent that the CCA relied on commutation power, it did so in error, Your Honor. And we believe that the correct approach, again, would be our approach, which is a type-for-type or categorical approach. If, however, Your Honor, we were to get into the CCA's approach, and if this court did adopt that approach, We believe appellant should still be entitled to relief. This court should reverse because a bad conduct discharge, while it might very well be a bar to benefits by the VA if awarded at a general court-martial, there's no such categorical bar to benefits at a special court-martial. We cite in our reply brief a military law review article authored by Major Lippert. There, he notes that under Volume 38 of the Code of Federal Regulations, a special court-martial bad conduct discharge is dealt with differently than a bad conduct discharge at a general court-martial. For example, a general court-martial discharge, again, it would tend to
So somebody is supposed to get into all this kind of collateral consequence to figure this out?
Well, Your Honor,
That's a little arcane, isn't it?
It is arcane, Your Honor, and that's unfortunately the analysis that the lower court engages in and the approach that the government advances today. And I think it's telling the convening authority's action, which is in our joint appendix. There, the convening authority noted that the sentence is approved but will not be executed until the NMCCA provides its legal review to determine whether or not that sentence is legal. And that could very well become the new norm, because if we adopt the approach of the CCA below, this court may be confronted with this case, although different forms of punishment going forward, but time and again. If it adopts the lineal approach or the type-for-type approach, this court would then provide predictability not only to appellate defense counsel who have to advise their clients whether or not they want to appeal, but also to convening authorities who struggle with the question of whether or not they can approve this sentence. Is it in excess of or more severe than?
On rehearing, the military judge is not aware of the prior sentence, are they?
No, they are not, Your Honor.
Therefore, my question is there some way, and this is a pure question, not a statement question, is there a way to craft the proceeding so that the parties are on record as to whether they think something is in excess of or more severe or whatever?
Or
is it impossible to do where the military judge is supposed to sentence on a clean slate and then look behind the box?
Well, I think there's two ways to answer that question, Your Honor. First, the military judge, or if it's members who are doing the resentencing, might not be informed. And in that case, they can still they can look at the sailor, marine, or service member and determine the character of that service member's service in conjunction with the criminality that he or she's been convicted of, and then craft a sentence that they believe is appropriate. And then, consistent with the Article 63 language, which speaks of approval, the convening authority then would then have to act on it and determine whether or not it comports with the in excess of or more severe clause. So that's one approach. The second approach would be to have the military judge make certain findings of fact to litigate this issue below, with the parties perhaps filing motions in limine either after trial on the merits or before trial on the merits, which would certainly just increase more litigation and bring this issue back before this court. Now, this court stated in United States v. Derisson that it's tended to discourage a table of substitutions. But if we agree with the approach taken by the government and the lower court here, when this issue comes up time and again, essentially a de facto table of substitutions will be created. This court will announce certain guideposts that will judge the CAs and the SJAs to determine whether or not a sentence is in excess of or more severe. And then we'll be back to the point where this court originally discouraged us from going, which is a table of substitutions.
Could the President articulate a table of substitutions in the manual for courts martial under the powers of Articles 36 and 56?
I'm sorry.
Could the President set forth a table of substitutions to be used? Seems that one of the underlying concerns is that in a case where a first court has only issued a punitive discharge, if there's not a table or some information about that, second court may come back with a sentence that doesn't include a punitive discharge, but he has some fairly severe punishments in it. And strictly applying the approach that defense has advocated here, wouldn't be unreasonable for members to say afterwards, gee, if we had known that we couldn't get any of these punishments in here, we would have sentenced to a punitive discharge.
So the short answer to that question, Your Honor, is yes. I don't see any reason why the President couldn't promulgate some sort of table of substitutions. But the second answer to that question is that, you know, alternatively, this court could state that trial counsel or the military judge could announce to the members, or conversely, the trial counsel could announce to the military judge what the previous sentence was, so that they know going forward what's on the table or what's not on the table. So I think that would address Your Honor's concerns, at least on that point. But one point that should be recognized is the language.
Is that what you want? Is that what you want brought into the court martial for consideration on sentencing, what the previous sentence was?
Well, no, Your Honor, because the court, the members should be able to determine holistically what the best sentence is for that service member. But if there's so that they shouldn't be able to, you know, it's probably not the best idea then to.
So would it be that the judge would instruct in a case like this, members, you can only sentence in this case to what? What would the instruction be?
Well, in this case, if we adopted the approach of Judge Brosman, for example, it would be those punishments that sound in loss of reputation, because bad conduct discharge, for example, would impugn someone's reputation. So we could have we could either have a reduction in rank to pay grade E1, or we could have a reprimand or some sort of admonition under that rubric. But it would be.
So that would be the president's guidance in the manual, that the judge will instruct, as the judge understanding what the punishment was at the prior trial, will instruct which punishments are available, and that if there's judge alone, you then assume that the judge will somehow be able to compartmentalize and instruct himself or herself in that regard.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but the language of the statute itself is focused on the convening authority. It used to have the language sentence imposed, but now it actually has the sentence approved. So
I understand that, but as I understand the underlying problem that the government is addressing, although they haven't quite articulated this way, is that you can wind up with a sentence that the members would not have adjudged had they known what the playing field was.
Yes, Your Honor, and certainly there would be any limitations to any rule that this court would endorse. But under Article 63, there's no express power to change one form of punishment to another. And that's contrasted with the Article 60 subsection C power, which is the commutation power that the convening authority has. So this is the rule that Congress has given us. It's given us language that comports with the categorical approach, having an excess of or more severe than. And it's also, as Chief Judge Everett noted in the United States v. Hall, given us a sort of service member-centric approach, because, as he stated in that opinion, obviously Congress feared service members might be reluctant to appeal if they knew going into their appeal and potential rehearing they might come out worse than they would have initially.
What punishment did your client ask for at his sentence rehearing?
At his sentence rehearing, Your Honor, our client asked for no punishment. Now, later on, defense counsel did state that if Your Honor wants to look at this as a sort of NJP offense because there were two orders violations, then His Honor could mete out any punishment that's consistent under an NJP. And I see my time has finished. May I finish my question? Thank you, Your Honor. So initially, he asked for no punishment, Your Honor. He did hedge a little bit, defense counsel did, in noting that because it was an NJP type offense with an orders violation, that the judge could alternatively give a sentence that's commensurate with that. But in the clemency request and at the original.
But you don't disagree that under NJP that some of the punishments that your client got are exactly the sorts of punishments that would be permissible under NJP, right?
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor.
Which ones weren't?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, I mean, a bad conduct discharge initially would not be something that.
Talk about the sentence that's before us.
Under the sentence that's before us, Your Honor, I believe all the punishments would be commensurate with the NJP type punishment. But I could certainly, if I'm mistaken on that, Your Honor, research that and get back to you.
And so, how does this not fit into the yet what you ask for language that's been discussed in the briefs?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
How does that then not fit into you get what you ask for concept that's discussed in the briefs?
Well, you get what you ask for concept applies in the United States v. Carter, which is a commutation case, Your Honor. It was a general court-martial commutation case where, again, the convening authority has this expressed authority to change one form of punishment into another. So here, that power is not at play. The only power that's at play is the in excess of or more severe clause, which is a cap to encourage service members to appeal their cases. And simply, it would not apply.
Doesn't 63 just premise itself on wiping the slate clean? You're saying, well, it doesn't formally give the authority to change. Why does it have to? It's premised on wiping the slate clean and resentencing.
Well, the slate isn't precisely wiped clean, Your Honor, because...
What? The judge doesn't hear the previous sentence. That's pretty clean, isn't it?
Well, certainly it has very clean, Your Honor.
Okay. But the then I don't get this as a matter of statutory construction.
Because it's the convening authority that ultimately has to decide whether or not the sentence is in excess of or more severe than. And that's why the language approved is in the statute. It's not the statute, or it doesn't say imposed or adjudged. It uses that term.
No, but I'm asking about 63.
Right, Your Honor. And in Article 63, the language is approved. So the slate is wiped clean at rehearing.
Okay, well, then you don't need a positive grant of authority to change the sentence. I thought you were saying that because there isn't a positive grant of authority to tinker with the sentence in 63, that therefore you're limited. Is that not what you're saying?
No, it's not what I'm saying, Your Honor. So the slate, I think that question...
What are you saying?
So the question should be handled, I think, in three parts. The first part is that upon rehearing, the court-martial or the military judge is able to give whatever sentence he or she or the members deem appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
That then goes to the convening authority, which is the second part. And the convening authority has to determine now, under Article 63, whether or not that sentence is in excess of or more severe than what was originally approved. And using, consistent with that 63 power, which only applies on rehearing, Your Honor, there's no express grant of authority to then change that punishment, which was given every hearing, into another form of punishment. And that's why, when we contrast that with Article 60, subsection C, where the convening authority is authorized to transform the punishment, we see that the convening authority is essentially...
Well, the convening authority is authorized to transform the punishment in 60 as a matter of commutation. He's got a punishment in front of him. In 63, you got a rehearing situation, which by definition wipes the slate clean. I still don't understand why this makes a difference in a matter of statutory construction.
Why don't you take that up as your first rebuttal argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Fair enough?
Fair enough.
Think about it and respond to Judge Stuckey's question on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government? This is a military precision movement.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Colonel Stephen C. Newman, United States Marine Corps, and I represent the United States. This court should affirm the lower court's holding that the sentence imposed at the second hearing was neither in excess of nor more severe than that imposed at the first. And I say this primarily based on the precedent this court has before it, and also that was laid out in the briefs.
How does the government define those two phrases, in excess of or more severe than?
I have two answers to that question. First off, when we look at the precedent, the courts don't seem to make a distinction between those two phrases. They tend to talk in terms of in excess of and more severe than. Second, if you look at in excess of, I think you're talking about sentences that are comparable. Whereas, if you look at more severe than, you're looking when you have sentences that are not comparable. So, for example, in this case here...
So you would agree pretty much with the defense on this?
I don't know that we would agree with the defense, Your Honor, primarily because the defense is positive that this court is a stovepipe type analysis, and we don't agree with the stovepipe type analysis. We agree with a totality of the circumstances reasonable person standard, as laid out in DeRusen, Kelly, and as cited in our brief. But I think that the best example of that is Mitchell, which was probably the worst case scenario in a sentence comparison type case, where you had an original sentence that was a BC in 10 years, followed by a second sentence that was a DD in 6 years, and trying to compare those two sentences. That's an example of where you have real issues with regards to in excess of the severity.
But in that case, this court applied essentially a stovepipe analysis in comparing the two discharges of one another and leaving the other alone.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but because that case was so severe with regards to its facts, It's kind of the worst-case scenario. What the court actually said was that they were not deciding the reasonable person standard at that time. They left that question for another time. Perhaps this is that time.
Why is it so clear, then, that this is not a comparable circumstance? I mean, how do we know what a BCD is worth to a particular person or even to a reasonable person?
There's a couple of ways to answer that question, Your Honor. There's several factors that you can pull out of the case law that help you answer that question. If you look at DeRusso, they look about what they ask, what did the appellant ask for? They ask, what did he seek from the court? If you look at Kelly, they look at the circumstances that are the four corners of the record. So there's a couple of ways you can figure that stuff out from looking at the four corners of the record, which brings me to my next point, which is where we should draw that line. I think if you look at Article 63, as this court is aware, Article 63 talks in terms of approved as opposed to imposed. As a result, you draw that line within the four corners of the record up to convening authority's action, because the convening authority is responsible for making that decision as to sentence comparison based on the statute.
Would the President have the authority to authorize the military judge to be aware of the prior sentence and to craft instructions accordingly as to what might be on the table? Is that within the power of the President under UCMJ?
Yes, Your Honor, he would have that authority. But in this case, we don't have that. What we do have is the precedent.
I understand that, but we're also thinking about what might go into an opinion in a case like this.
Yes, Your Honor. And what I would direct Your Honor's attention to is the precedent in this case in two contexts. First, in the straight-up sentence comparison context, and second, in the commutation context.
Do we take into account the structure of the UCMJ, and I'd specifically refer to the automatic appeal, which, looking at the legislative history of this provision in the House hearings on pages 322 and 323, the question arose as to whether the double jeopardy provisions in the military should be the same as in civilian life. And Mr. Larkin and Professor Morgan, who were representing the Department of Defense, said no for a variety of reasons. And with respect to the issue in this case, they said primarily because of the automatic appeal. That is, the military justice system, even though there's a possibility of waiver now, you don't have the obligation to affirmatively appeal. And there was a desire to avoid any kind of disincentive or problem for the accused based upon the fact of the automatic appeal. And they said, and Professor Morgan said, put simply, the sentence can't be increased. How does this particular case comport with the underlying policy of not having a sentence increased?
By virtue of the fact that the bad conduct discharge is, as the court in Kelly laid out, looking at that exact issue, they said that it can hardly be argued that any of the sentences that were available to that court were more severe than or in excess of a punitive discharge.
But what about all of them together?
All the sentences together, sir, even considering them all together, still not more severe than a punitive discharge.
How do you know that?
In that regard, Your Honor, it's helpful to look at United States versus Ort, which we submitted to the court as a supplemental site last week. Ort lays out exactly what a punitive discharge is. Punitive discharge is different and distinct than any other form of punishment.
Which is an argument for why you can't compare them.
Well, I would disagree, Your Honor. I think it's an honest look. It's an argument for why it's more severe. And again, that gets back.
So BCD is always more severe. It's more severe than 1 year. It's more severe than 30 years. It's more severe than. How do you know?
By looking at the four corners of the record, Your Honor. By applying that totality of the circumstances test, and by applying that.
So a BCD is more severe than how much confinement?
It depends on the circumstances, Your Honor. I hate to be slippery.
But what circumstance am I looking to? What the appellant asked for?
What the appellant
asked
for?
So an appellant, after we write your opinion, all appellants on rehearing will ask for no punishment. They got the memo, no punishment.
That's right.
So now we're left to provide advice to the CA in a context where every appellant on rehearing has asked for no punishment. What is more severe than BCD in terms of confinement, and what is your response?
My response is that you're not just looking at what the appellant asks for. You're also looking at what is available to the court as other punishments. For example, in Smith and Kelly, those courts had available to them other punishments that court ruled was necessarily less severe than a BCD. So you also look at those factors. You do look at the circumstances that apply to the individual accused, but only in terms of what's on the record up to committing authority action. That's where we draw that line in the sand. And again, I point to committing authority action because that's what Article 63 contemplates, is that the committing authority is going to be the one who approves that sentence. So it's not just what the respondent or the appellant or the accused asks for.
So it's totally case by case. That is, if you have a case in which we're in a general court-martial, which we're not here, but let's say we assume we're in a general court-martial, and the maximum is a DD in 40 years, let's say, for the way all the offenses stack up, and the accused gets either a DD or a BCD. On rehearing, how much confinement can the individual get? Is there a point in which the amount of confinement becomes in excess of or more severe?
I would not stand before you, Your Honor, and suggest that there's never a point in time where that does not occur. For example, if an individual were to receive 100 years confinement, that necessarily means that he's more than likely to die in confinement as opposed to receiving a bad conduct discharge. Under those circumstances,
you have to have an actuarial table to figure this out? Yeah, I mean, you know, might not die in 40 years, but can we think of anyone who would not trade a 40 years confinement for a DD? I want my DD back. Why did I ever appeal that case?
Your Honor, I would point you to that individual record and ask that you examine that based on the circumstances of that particular case.
Okay.
An individual appellant who is youthful may find that a term of confinement initially is more appealing, or a BCD is more appealing, depending on his circumstances. However, down the road, that BCD may well have much more impact. You look at the case law, it talks about the lingering and long-lasting, lifelong impacts of punitive discharge. So another factor that this court should consider is the age of the appellant. And I think that comes straight out of the case law.
On page 6 of your brief, you've asked us to consider the administrative consequences of this situation. Specifically, you note that the appellant fails to acknowledge that the absence of a discharge necessarily means he has employment with the Navy, and the benefits of a general and honorable discharge are logical and probable consequences of a successfully completed term of agreement, et cetera. Since you've raised that, I've taken a look briefly at some of the Navy regulations, and I may be out of my area of expertise here, but looking at MIL-PERS Man 1910-233, there's mandatory processing for sexual harassment. Are you saying in your brief there's a guarantee that he won't be processed and that he won't get a less than honorable discharge here? How do we know that the day that this conviction becomes final, somebody in the Navy, Naval Service, won't turn around, take a look at this regulation, and send him to an administrative discharge board where he can get a less than honorable discharge in which the consequences are quite similar to a BCD?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And other than honorable discharge, it has similar characteristics to a bad conduct discharge. However, let's play that out a little bit. If that individual, if were to notify a petty officer altogether that he's going to an administrative separation board, he would be able to stand in front of that board convicted not of the greater offense that he was initially charged with, but the lesser offense, and also with 16 years of service at that point, because it's been 2 years since his initial sentence, he's closer to 17, 18 years of service. He stands a reasonable chance at that board, even if they do separate, of getting a favorable characterization of service. In fact, I think the regulations, I don't know, I'd be happy to present briefs on this if the court's interested, but I think the regulations may restrict what type of discharge characterization he can receive.
At less than 18 years of service?
After a punitive discharge has been available to a sentence.
Yeah. Okay. That would be, I mean, I'm not in a position to ask now without the concurrence of my colleagues. Leave it up to the government to decide whether they want to submit supplemental authority on that matter.
Counsel, wouldn't it be easier to have a type of bright line rule for instance, of comparing one type of sentence to another, rather than throwing the convening authorities into this quagmire every time they get a sentence on rehearing, trying to make a comparison. And you've said that certainly in some cases a 100-year sentence would be more severe than a BCD. Where do you draw the line? What does he look at? Just from an administrative position, wouldn't it be easier just to have, this is what the rules are, this is what you're going to have to live with?
Well, yes, Your Honor. The stovepipe analysis that's posited by the appellant is very seductive in that regard, because it's seductive in its simplicity. However, I would suggest that it's also contrary to the precedent, which states that the sentence has to be considered as a whole. I would also suggest...
But Mitchell didn't say that.
Sorry, Your Honor?
Mitchell didn't say that. Mitchell did, at least the way it was applied, and that's our most recent Article 62 case.
But Mitchell, Your Honor, was, as I stated, that the worst-case scenario where you have an increase in the severity of the punitive discharge and, I'm sorry, an increase in the punitive discharge, which means it's in excess, and a decrease in the amount of confinement. So
was it a hard case that made bad law?
Sorry, Your Honor?
Was it a hard case that made bad law?
Well, I think that Mitchell is helpful in a couple of ways. First off, because it clearly says that a term of confinement is finite, but the stigma of a punitive discharge is long-lasting. So it's helpful in that regard. Mitchell is a very limited opinion, I think, but by virtue of the fact that the court was really looking at the discharge and comparing the discharge and not looking they had difficulty looking at the sentence as a totality. But in direct answer to your question, I think the stovepipe analysis also ignores Article 63, because Article 63 talks about the sentence as a whole. It contemplates the sentence as a whole, and it talks about in excess of or more severe than. I think it's suggesting that the committing authority needs to consider the sentence as a whole. And certainly that's consistent with all the holdings of this court.
Judge Ryan?
Assuming that the three judges on the court don't agree with the analysis that you proposed, can you explain your view of what would happen next?
To Pedro Altier, or in a holistic perspective?
To the appellant in this case.
He would receive the punishment?
Other than what he's already received.
Well, Your Honor, other than the conviction itself. The conviction, as this court has found in the past, a conviction in and of itself is a punishment. However, the punishment that was adjudged by the court would not happen.
Just returning to some things we were discussing before, it seems to me that if there are objectively circumstances in which a sentence cannot be approved by the convening authority because it would be in excess of or more severe, we have a situation now in which we are asking court-martial members to adjudge sentences which are not on the table. Is that in effect where we are right now?
And that's a concern that I raised in my brief, Your Honor, is that the situation that the way the statute is constructed and the situation that we have may lead the members to impose a sentence that they necessarily cannot stand.
And there may be other reasons to not go down this route, but would that aspect be cured if the judge instructed the members as to which sentences were on the table?
Yes, Your Honor, it would. However, my concern there would be the statutory construct of Article 63 and United States versus Davis, which lays out a brief history about Article 63 and how the term imposed was changed to as appellant's counsel articulated correctly, when Congress speaks, their words usually have meaning.
Could I ask a legal policy question which doesn't have to do with this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
If you were to start over again, how might you structure it?
I would structure it so that you mean in the absence of the language of Article 63?
Right. We will now make you Mr. Morgan and all members of Congress at once, plus the President. Congratulations.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate it.
How would you craft it?
I would craft it such that on sentence rehearings, the military judge knows, so that he can then instruct the members, or if there is no panel, such that he knows what can and cannot be imposed, because a military judge is necessarily trained to understand those types of subtleties. The competing authority has the benefit of the staff judge advocate, and not to although the role of the statute advocate, sometimes it's a little more complicated to get those messages passed conveniently. I would suggest that the military judge is the proper authority to know, that he should know what was the previous sentence was, and should therefore limit the punishments on instructions. That way, we don't run into a situation where a panel feels like they've been, for lack of better words, deceived as to what they can and cannot impose.
Thank you, counsel. Are there other questions up here? Do you have a closing comment or anything? You're not required to.
Well, Your Honor, I'll just simply close by the way I would and asking this court to affirm the lower court's holding and rule that the sentence imposed in the second half was necessarily less severe than imposed in the first.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honors. Judge Stuckey, to directly try to answer your question, Your Honor, what I'd like to say is that there's really what we have on rehearing, a partially clean slate. And that's because of, one, there's the in excess of or more severe language in the statute that the members of the military judge are confronting in the judging a sentence. And two, the military judge knows, because it's a rehearing, there was some sentence given previously, so that there is some cap that's out there. So that would be my best answer to that question, Your Honor.
Thank you.
But I'd like to highlight the questions that this court asked of the government, and to point out that reasonable convening authorities, be it Air Force, Navy, whatever service, might very well disagree on whether 6 months confinement or here 30 days confinement and the additional punishments are in excess of or more severe than a bad conduct discharge. And I see my time's running out, but at a bad conduct discharge, at least there's the Navy Discharge Review Board, or the Board for Correction of Naval Records, where such a discharge could be upgraded. A convening authority might recognize that and note that, well, I could, if I want to be harsh in my sentencing, impose a term of confinement to take this service member away from his family or from the job sector. So a convening authority could certainly do that, and a reasonable convening authority might disagree. And that's why this court should provide clear guidance in the rule advanced by appellant today. And the rule is not only seductive in its simplicity, contrary to what the government asserts, Your Honors, it's also seductive in its logic, because it most comports with what we believe is this categorical approach of the in excess of or more severe law. That language must contemplate sentences which are quantifiable on the one hand, hence the in excess of language, and sentences which are not, hence the more severe language. So for these reasons, Your Honor, we ask the court to reverse the lower court, to breathe life into the in excess of language of Article 63, and to provide predictability to convening authorities, staff judge advocates, and attorneys advising their clients, so that this matter does not need to be relitigated again. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks both counsel. The case is submitted, and we will stand in recess until 10:55. Thank you.
The court stands in recess until 10:55.